CMU Podcast in association with 7Digital.
Hello there. Welcome to this special edition of the CMU Podcast. We promised you last week. Andy Malt is not here this week. Actually, I'm not here either, because as you're listening to this, I'm currently talking about copyright in the music business in Barbados. I don't quite sure how that came about, but it's going to be very exciting. By the time you've heard this, actually, I will be pretty much at the end of that little event. So I'm not in London this week, and so we didn't get Andy into the studio either. And instead, we have decided to do a special edition of the podcast because there's somebody that we've talked about quite a bit on past editions of the podcast since the start of the year, which is the musician and very vocal artist rights activist David Lowry, who, of course, was behind one of the big class action lawsuits against Spotify with regards to the way mechanical royalties are collected and paid in the US. That all kicked off late last year, but David's been writing about and speaking about the evolution of the digital market and especially the streaming market for about 5 or 6 years now, and has said some quite controversial stuff and is sometimes seen as somebody who is critical of services that other people in the artist community sometimes think, well, actually, I quite like that service. Why are you being so critical? Why are you going after them? But having said that, also very informed and has lots of interesting things to say. David got in touch with us earlier in the year and said, I like your podcast. Can I come on and have a chat? And it's like, that's a great idea. So I'm going to have a chat now with David. I don't quite know how long this podcast will end up being because we've got so much to cover. We'll try and get it down to the usual about an hour time. But it's a great interview, so do stick through and listen to all of the things that he and myself have to say. So that's this special edition. It's me, Chris Cook from CMU. I didn't intro myself, did I? Hello, I'm Chris Cook from CMU, and it's me talking to David Lowry about all things digital music and streaming. So I have David here for this special edition of the CMU podcast. Thanks for joining us on the line, David.
Well, thank you. How did I rate a special edition?
Because Andy Malt's not here. When Andy's not here, we call it a special edition for some reason.
Oh, okay. That's great.
But also, I suppose normally on our podcast, we're talking about events that have happened in the week just gone, whereas we're going to talk to you about some current events, but also to sort of get your backstory, but also your opinions on some of the issues. Well, we've been talking about you on the podcast in the last year, so sort of get your take on some of the events that are happening and sort of the immediate and maybe further future of the digital music market as you see it. But before we get into streaming and Spotify and mechanical royalties and data and all of those issues that we've been talking about in your absence, I suppose for the uninitiated, because we've been reporting on you, well, both as a musician, but particularly as someone who has talked a lot about the way the music industry is going and the digital music industry is going for a number of years now. But I suppose let's just start by getting a bit of background of you as the musician and the songwriter, rather than as you as the opinionated blogger about music. So just give us, as quickly as you can, a quick plotted history of your music career to date.
Right. So I started with an indie rock band called Camper Van Beethoven in 1983 in Santa Cruz, California. And we were at the vanguard, I guess, of the indie rock movement. We cut a production distribution kind of deal with Rough Trade around in 1985. We were one of these quirky American bands who were first played in the UK, and then our popularity kind of washed back over to the United States.
Yeah, so you kick things off over here and then built on that back home.
Yes, exactly. So in a lot of ways, we're sort of, that band in a way is more important, like sort of less commercially than sort of how we were going about our business and, you know, sort of being part of the indie rock movement. We were at the vanguard of that. And then, of course, Cracker sort of evolved out of that in 1991 or so. This is now we're on a major independent, Virgin Records.
Did you work with Warner at some point with Cracker? Am I right in saying that?
Well, we did work at Warner in the sense that Virgin in the United States was distributed by Warner.
I see. So you were signed to Virgin. And that was indie era Virgin or EMI era Virgin?
It was indie era Virgin at first. It was an interesting time. It was a nice transition into the majors. We had a gold and then a platinum record with Virgin in the United States. We were largely swept up sort of in the alternative movement, but again, like commercially, we did pretty well, but I think a little more of significance of the band Cracker was that we were sort of the first band in sort of the Americana movement to get mainstream radio play. Even though we were considered kind of part of the alternative movement, we definitely, you know, made these sort of country rock albums and such. And that's sort of my quick story, some commercial success. We were sort of at the vanguard of two different movements here in the United States and to a certain extent the UK.
And I suppose given that you have become a sort of very vocal advocate of artist rights and very vocal on digital music, and obviously that's what we're going to come and spend most of this podcast talking about, but I suppose it is important to stress that you are still writing and recording and performing music today.
Yes, and in fact we've just sort of wound down about 18 months of touring for an album we put out at the end of 2014, so we're about to go into another recording cycle. But we're still out there playing and touring. I'm definitely still involved in all, you know, and still involved in the creative side of the business. You know, I've also done a lot of producing through the years. I mean, I've also been involved in like what we call in the United States sort of the jingle or custom music part of the business, video editing suites, recording studios. My wife is a concert promoter of some note. It's kind of the family business. I've got my hands sort of in a lot of different cookie jars. I'm mixing metaphors here. I'm not doing very good here today. I'm just in a lot of different parts of the business. And of course, I teach at the University of Georgia.
So that's an important point to bring up is so therefore you do see the business as a creator, as a songwriter, as a performer, but you also have fingers in pies. So you see it from the production side and the industry side too.
Yeah. Exactly.
And in terms of, I think I first became aware of you being vocal about the way the music industry was developing and the way digital was developing, I don't know whether it was about 5 or 6 years ago. I know you did a panel for Music Tank here in London. I think that was about 4 or 5 years ago. And that was when streaming was first starting to gain a bit of momentum. Uh-huh. And I suppose, were you always opinionated about the industry side from the very early days with the original band? Or was it something that as you got more involved in other projects that you started to become more opinionated about? Or was it when you started to see the shifts with CDs going into decline, the download boom, and then the sort of the slow shift towards the streaming platforms? At what point did you become so opinionated on everything?
Well, I mean, I think it began in the beginning. I mean, the indie rock movement was kind of a quasi-political movement in that it was sort of a movement based on artists owning their own recordings and retaining as many rights as possible and sort of having a different structure with the established music business. Even when we went to Virgin, you know, we had a great deal of autonomy and control over what we were doing. So in a way, at first, I had a critique of the traditional music business going back to the indie rock movement. And then that kind of gradually shifted. I should mention something here that few people report on. You know, I was very pro-digital when the change began.
So in that whole era when the majors were trying to sue all the fans and everyone was sort of grasping with, where is it heading? We just know CD sales seem to have peaked. So in those early days of download, So were you a big supporter of, say, of the iTunes store, which came to dominate the first era of digital music?
I mean, I don't know specifically the iTunes store, but yes, making music available to digitally download seemed really imperative at that time, because otherwise people were just going to take it with things like Napster and Grokster and LimeWire and stuff like that. So when the iTunes store came along, I felt very good about that. In, say, 2006 or 2007, around then, I started working on a solo record. At that, let me just give you an example of how things have changed for me. At that point, to me, the issues were still more about artistic control, right? We'd been through this period where, you know, record labels and sort of major magazines and major media outlets were gatekeepers. And to artists, financial issues were probably almost secondary to issues of creative control.
So access to audience, I suppose, is how do you reach, because it was that period. And I think sometimes people forget that in the 90s, to give a UK example, here in the UK, if you couldn't get HMV to stock your records and you couldn't get Radio 1 to play them and you couldn't get Enemy to write about you, it was really hard,
right,
however good your music was, to find a fan base.
That's exactly true. And so that's the confusing thing about the digital revolution, I think, that's never really been written about, is on one hand, artists saw it as a threat to their revenue streams. but in another way, they were like, well, we're liberated creatively. We're bypassing a lot of the gatekeepers. Now, that turns out to be a little bit false, but we can get into that in a minute. But it appeared that we were going to bypass a lot of the gatekeepers, and I think for a while we did. And that was really important to artists, and I think so a lot of artists like myself accepted that piracy was going, informal or commercial, was going to increase. But in exchange, we would have more artistic creativity. There was this promise of disintermediation where we can deal directly with our fans. And my calculation was, I thought, well, we're going to lose more money to unlicensed copying. But maybe because we're dealing directly with our fans by taking out the middlemen, that ultimately will make more money.
Yes, and I suppose, and remembering that, I mean, you were working with indies, and perhaps you said you cut a very good deal with Virgin, but I mean, for a lot of artists then and now, they were middlemen taking a lot of the money.
Yeah.
It wasn't 10% here and there. On a sort of classic major label deal, they were taking most of the money.
Right. And, you know, later as I sort of got older and more sophisticated and sort of thought about things more, well, you know, part of that, the old label structure, them taking so much money had a lot to do with, you know, they were basically operating like these pharma firms or, you know, high risk. You had such a terrible royalty rate because so many of the projects were failures. You know, essentially,
yes,
you had to share this risk among a bunch of bands and stuff like that, right?
Yeah, no, I have in one of my training courses, I have a slide where I do defending the record companies, and that's where I have all the boxes of all the investments that a label, and I think it's still true to an extent, all the investments a major label does that never make any money. And that's why when it does make money, they want to keep so much of the money to subsidize the 9 projects that lost everybody money.
You're essentially paying for losses.
Yeah.
So, and I think nowadays that can change a little bit because you can look out and see, I watch my wife when she's booking concerts. Sometimes a band will come up and she doesn't really know about them. So she'll like start looking at YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Looking at the number of comments, you know, how engaged people are. There's a lot of essentially beta testing that goes on. Like, essentially, labels can step in at a later part of a band's career now. So the win-loss ratio isn't quite as terrible for record labels
Or it shouldn't be.
it shouldn't be. Right, exactly. And so that's actually a really fundamental thing that's changed the shape of the business that nobody ever talks about. A lot of that R&D is sort of been crowdsourced that labels had to spend a lot of money on before that.
Yeah, in theory should be reducing some of the risk accordingly.
Right.
So
artists should be able to make more money, but it's still an unpredictable business. I mean, there's still no way to predict what's going to become a hit and what isn't.
One thing I always say with labels, I mean, sometimes labels sign stupid bands or they make stupid decisions or stupid marketing decisions. Having said that, you know, I think we've all seen labels that sign great artists with great songs. They do a great marketing campaign. Everything should work. And for some reason, it doesn't. And
right.
and if only we could work out why that was, we could become millionaires. And I suppose to an extent, that is life. There's always going to be a bit of luck involved.
That's correct, yeah.
So, I mean, I agree totally with you. We may disagree when we get a bit further onto this conversation, but at the moment, I totally agree. And one thing I always say is, for me, the biggest innovation that the rise of the web brought to music is that direct-to-fan relationship that artists simply didn't have prior to mainstream adaptation of the internet and the data that you can pull and the fact that you can sell direct and cut out some of the middlemen, if not all of the middlemen. And I think that is, for me, the revolution. And I don't think the music industry has completely worked out the potential of that yet. I think there's huge opportunities there for artists and for their managers and indeed for labels to better capitalize on all of that. But I suppose if we move the conversation on a little bit to the way the digital market has evolved. So you say that initially you saw the download platforms, there being positives there, and particularly the fact that an iTunes store could stock everybody, whereas an old-fashioned record shop couldn't. At what point did you become more concerned, critical, whatever the word is, of the way the digital market was going?
Right. So I think I tend to be very tangential. And I went off on a tangent. But what I started to say was around 2006, 2007, I was going to make a solo record. And then I thought, you know, I was looking at YouTube and I was like, well, that looks like MTV to me, which had previously been sort of a driver of sales. So it's like, why don't I just, instead of making an album, I'll just record 12 songs and make 12 videos and put them directly on YouTube and see what happens. And that's where I was, 2006, 2007, you know, that's sort of the peak of my digital sort of boosterism, and then it trails off from there.
Okay? That's interesting. So I think that's another thing. I don't think necessarily it's a surprise that you were positive about iTunes, but the fact that you were quite an early adopter on this thing called YouTube and the potential it had to get content out there.
Right. Well, it just, what a great way to engage directly with your fans. But as I went along in this, so this takes about 5 years for me to really complete this cycle. But I begin to see that, well, recorded music revenues are falling, and they continue to fall, and they're falling past this sort of break-even point where I thought, like, disintermediation versus sort of unrestrained file sharing was going to sort of even out, and there's going to be a break-even point. It kind of went through that floor. You know?
So even taking out the middleman, it was still getting possible to break even.
Yeah, and of course, physical products were in decline. And remember, for niche artists, especially bands like Camper Van Beethoven, I mean, it was really about selling albums, not about selling singles. And then suddenly we're in a world where we're selling singles or three or four tracks off of an album. That's a problem. There wasn't anybody to blame for that. You know, I mean, there wasn't anybody.
Well, I suppose that's just a change,
you know.
It was iTunes that forced through that you had to sell everything track by track. I mean, I remember Radiohead held off iTunes for a while because of that. They said they want to sell albums and Apple wouldn't let them.
Right.
Although I think Apple would say they were sort of responding to what consumers wanted.
Well, and yes, I think they were. And I think that actually is correct. There are some bands that I love three or four of their songs, but I'm not going to listen to their entire album. I mean, what can you do about that? That's just a change. And there's not much you can do about that. And so it's just something that we had to accept. But I think really what began to bother me was that it just seemed like in 2012, I went to San Francisco Music Tech and I gave this sort of informal little talk. It was sort of a lecture that I was working on at the time, and it was really just kind of a beta of it. And it was, meet the new boss worse than the old boss, ? And what I really started getting into was whether the percentage of revenue that the artists were actually capturing from these new digital platforms was really working. And one of my main points was that the entire discussion up till about 2012 was, we're still trying to figure out the digital. Well, actually, the discussion is still now this. We're still trying to figure out the digital model, right? And the digital model, to me, in 2012, I looked at it, I said, it's completely stable. It's been stable for 6 years, right?
That being the iTunes model.
Well, you have there's three legs to it. There's the digital downloads. There's the streaming, whether it's YouTube user-generated content or these new platforms like Spotify. At that time, 2012 is a new platform in the United States, 6 months old. And piracy, whether that's cyber lockers or torrenting, right? You have three legs to how music's digitally distributed, right? And when you look at all three of those, the artist share of revenue seemed lower. I'm not talking about just, you know, that we were getting less overall. It just seemed like the actual percentage was potentially lower. Now, that's aggregating things like Apple paid subscription streaming services, largely licensed, and YouTube, which is not very licensed. Okay.
Yes,
shall we say it that way?
You
know what I mean? So anyway, go on. But your question.
iTunes model, with the download model, there, I think the download store was taking a cut of the money similar to what the record shop would have been taken. So I think iTunes always saw itself as, well, we're a record shop. We'll take the cut that the record shop owner used to take, and then we'll pass on this, pretty much what we used to pass on to the label and the publisher and the songwriter and the artist. Except, I suppose, the point that you've made earlier, but if you're only selling four tracks instead of an album, even if you're getting the same share, you're getting less money for each release, I guess. Whereas once you get onto streaming, then it's a totally different model.
Right, but for instance, with the download store, the actual price of the albums came down.
Yes, that's true.
And the digital stores, I mean, look, the physical stores had rent, they had stoned employees, things would break or disappear from their stores. They had a different sort of level of advertising and stuff like that, although a lot of that was paid by the record labels. With downloads, you know, record companies lost or managed to get rid of a lot of their expenses. You weren't moving around physical products. You didn't have warehouses and stuff like that, right? So my argument was, and this is the least important of my arguments, my argument was that, well, artists kept their same royalty rate while the record labels lost a fair amount of their expenses. Now, I don't know how significant. I know that promotion is a huge expense for record labels.
Because I've had that very conversation with a number of record labels in the last year where you say the minute you're almost digital only, CDs have gone, no vans, no warehouses, there's a significant line out of your budget taken out. And the comeback nearly always, whether it's major or indie, is, but our marketing costs have gone up. Because there's now so much more noise out there, we have to spend more on marketing. And so actually, overall, we're spending pretty much the same amount as we used to. Which, I mean, that's what labels are telling me. We can choose to believe them or not believe them. But I think that would be their comeback to that.
Well, there's probably some truth to that. I can't imagine that it's... I mean, you used to have to spend a lot of money on marketing and promotion in the old days, too. So there's some... The truth is somewhere in the middle there, I would imagine. Yeah. And it's really kind of a minor point. It kind of shows the direction that things headed for artists from that point forward.
So I suppose if we move on to the streaming services, and I think when I first sort of heard you speak and read what you were writing, at that point it seemed to be that you were speaking a lot more about the sort of Pandora-type services, so personalised radio, than the Spotify-type services, because it's always remembering from a European perspective that we never really had the personalised radio services. Spotify launched in 2008 and it gained momentum by 2010, and we never really had the Pandora-type services, which in the US have this unique compulsory licence that doesn't exist over here, right, where the rate wasn't set by either the label or the service provider, let alone the artist. It was set by government, and Pandora just was paying those rates, and it seemed to be that nobody was happy with those rates. Pandora wasn't, the labels weren't, the publishers weren't, certainly the artists weren't.
It was low to begin with. What really catalyzed that, though, was when Pandora sort of spearheaded the attempt to essentially lower those rates by introducing a bill into Congress. That's, I think, when a lot of artists and rights holders turned on Pandora, because I don't think we were happy with the rates at that point. When that happened, it just became sort of all-out warfare. They've since sort of backed off of that. And they also sort of stopped their legal court challenges to the BMI and ASCAP stuff. So I think...
I suppose in the last year, 18 months, it does feel like there's been a culture change there, which is possibly because they have ambitions to morph into a Spotify. And so they know at that point they won't be able to rely on the Sound Exchange license. So they need to start those conversations and winning back a little bit of support on the industry side.
Right. And that's correct. And I think actually in some ways they've been successful with that. I mean, you don't see the tricordist writing about Pandora much lately other than that, they agreed to this license or that license or stuff like that. So I think they've managed to sort of restore some trust in our community. I mean, I'm still always on guard about this stuff. But yeah, in a lot of ways, we've moved past that. I mean, we just wrote something recently about how it looks like we get an audit right, which is bizarre, but people don't know this in the United States. But a lot of the compulsory licenses, you couldn't actually audit the services to see if they were playing.
Sound Exchange's word for it.
and so that's kind of crazy. So it looks like the direct license they're offering now has got a nice give on the audit rights and stuff like that. I think that's a good olive branch. So that has changed. And personalized radio was always this weird beast. I think part of one of the reasons it didn't end up going around the world was it's sort of a half step between what the consumers want, which is sort of on-demand streaming, and old school radio. And it feels like a transitional format, and it's always felt like a transitional format. That's the only...
And that seems to be what Pandora is saying now. I mean, I know there have been people who have attempted to launch them over here, albeit unsuccessful. Some people have said perhaps it has more mainstream potential because you do just press a button and it plays you music.
Mm-hmm.
So for a full-on music fan, that's annoying because you don't want it to tell you what you've got to listen to. But for a more casual music fan who just wants to press a button in the car and then have some music play, perhaps there is a model that is more attractive than a Spotify-type service. But as I say, although various startups over here have tried to put that argument forward, and part of me is sympathetic to that argument, although none of them have succeeded. So.
Right. And, well, this is the problem across the entire industry, is that none of these things have succeeded in the sense that they're even profitable. So we've taken a hit to the value of our songs and recordings, and yet, they're not producing this sustainable industry. But that doesn't look like the future to me. I mean, yes, it's a nice technology, but I don't know.
By that, you mean personalized radio. You see that as being an intermediary in the way that downloads turned out to be an intermediary to something that we're heading towards.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's just was a transitional stage, and now we're on to something else.
And is the something else the Spotify-type model, the Tidal type model?
Absolutely. And here's two things that may surprise people about this. I think in a lot of ways, since Cracker has, at least in the United States, we had these top 10 sort of modern rock or rock radio tracks. This is five or six of them, depending on how you count them. And they've continued to be these recurrent songs or classic tracks that get played and stuff like that. So 23 years after the release of a song like
People are still
Love,
going back.
Yeah, and it's still getting played almost as much as it was when it first came out, because modern rock radio was a very small niche format at that time. It ended up getting bigger. But yeah, I was like, I have almost as much radio play as I did when we had, or when our hits were current and not recurrent. So for instance, for Cracker, revenues from streaming, I think they're probably a wash, if not slightly positive. for a band like Camper Van Beethoven that relies more on album sales, deep tracks, more of a niche band, it's kind of a disaster. So
I'm not even consistent
in my own career. You know what I'm saying? With my two bands, I can't even have a consistent answer on whether Spotify, if you ask me, is Spotify good for my band, I have to say which one, and then I have two different answers.
Well, I think that's a really interesting point that we will come back to at the end, the idea that the way the business is heading works for some artists and some not others. But I mean, if we stay with Spotify or Spotify-type services, so the on-demand services rather than Pandora-type services, and I suppose when you, through your speeches and writing, sort of started to take aim at those sorts of services, when, as you say, they arrived in the US later and they started to gain some momentum, that was the point at which, when I was sort of reading your stuff, it's like, well, I understand your objection to Pandora because it's statutory license and that's out of everyone's control, and Pandora seems to be spending all of their money lobbying to get that rate down, and I understand that frustration. Whereas with Spotify, well, they've done deals with the labels and publishers, they paid a lot of money up front. There wasn't the statutory license element to it, I suppose, is my point. And so it's sort of like, so what is the beef there? Because the big beef with Pandora doesn't apply to Spotify.
Well, let's talk about the sound recording first, because there is a compulsory, more or less, with this composition.
On the publishing, yeah.
Yeah, on the publishing. Well, it took a while to figure out exactly what was going on. It's okay, right? So are rates low, or is what's being passed through from the record labels low? And it turns out there's not a good answer there. Yes, indeed, the record labels did trade equity. They didn't necessarily trade it for lower royalty rates, but they allowed Spotify a lot of leeway. Not just Spotify, but all the streaming services, a lot of leeway in how they were going to generate revenue. So one of the things was, is a lot of stuff was given away free. So in a sense, yes, by trading equity, they essentially traded that for a lower royalty rate, which is unfair, I think, from the artist perspective, because essentially we're investing our sound recordings into these services. But then Sony has said they'll share the upside from this equity or whatever with artists. And, you know, the devil's in the details, but that's a positive development. I believe Warner has done the same thing as well, too. For me, I was looking at, like, albums that were maybe sold a few hundred copies a month in my Camper Van Beethoven catalog. And then, you know, now that they're sort of being streamed, the revenue and sort of those catalog albums collapsed from streaming revenues, from my viewpoint. This was not a good deal. Like I said, with Cracker, it looked to be more of a wash, because we're getting these songs are hits and they're landing in playlists like 20 alternative rock tracks from 1994 or something like that. You know, I don't know what these playlists are, but they drive a lot of traffic.
So I suppose going back to that distinction, I suppose, so almost it's possibly it's less the rate or the rev share or whatever. It's possibly the model, and also, I suppose, the way in which the money is shared out across everybody in that. And I know there are some indie labels who have got more vocal about this recently, that if I was to pay Spotify £10 a month and only listen to your music, that doesn't mean you get my £10.
Right.
It means that my £10 is put into a pot and then it's divvied up based on consumption across every single track ever, and so you might get a pound of my £10. And that was clearly set up to skew to the big rights owners. And I don't know if there's anything we can do about that now, but that's another element of how the model will work for some artists and not others.
Right. So just to back up one second, there's a lot of times that we tend to talk about things, and I'm guilty of it when we're blogging, just because I can't write a 6,000 word blog, but we sort of tend to simplify these things as if somebody somewhere planned all of this to screw artists, right? You've spent time in the music business. I've spent time in the music business. Nobody is foresighted enough to plan these kind of things. These are just all bad accidents that, to me, are based on sort of bad short-term logic. Right? That these kind of things have happened to artists, okay? It's hard to say that in a blog where typically readers tend to trail off after 1,000 words.
It's true.
But there is some of this that needs to be sort of, some of the emotion needs to be taken out of this. And I'm as guilty as anyone else when we're writing blogs about doing this. But you see that, okay, let's do this subscription, $10 a month, right? And we'll have sort of this free service that leads people into it, right? Okay, that's great. But there are so many unintended consequences that come out of that I think even in 2012, when I first started writing about this, I don't think I was really aware of how that logic was going to lead to unintended bad things for artists, right? I didn't start out complaining about streaming services weren't even really on my list. So at the top of my list probably were BitTorrent, CyberLockers, and then YouTube, UGC, right?
Yeah.
If I had to make a list then, that's what was on the top of my list.
It always struck me with the growth of digital that there was a whole period where the labels were aware of, oh, if we get involved in this business, it's going to screw over this business. And so we shouldn't do this because it will stop CDs. We shouldn't do this. It will stop downloads. Mm-hmm. But then you sort of sensed about 2008, 2009, I think because they realized that CDs by that point had tanked. Mm-hmm. It was far from certain that downloads were the future. You sort of sensed that at the labels, there was a moment of them just saying, oh, screw it. We'll license everything and see what sticks. And I suppose on one level, that was liberating because it stopped the labels just saying no, no, no to every single startup that came in, some of whom had good ideas. But then, yes, you probably then have the unintended consequences of, well, okay, well, we'll try this, we'll try this, we'll try this. But that one in the middle might then roll and there may be issues with that that stop us making money elsewhere. I sort of see that we're still in the experiment. I don't think we're there yet.
I think so. And I think these things like windowing tracks, things like this are part of the experiment to try to, can we look more like television? Yes. Are we going to completely turn into what the television business is, where you have HBO over here and you have a Netflix over here and you have an Amazon Video over here and everybody's got their own exclusives? No, that's not going to happen. We're experimenting with it, with things like windowing and all kinds of other stuff like that. Yes.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think things like windowing, certainly windowing off freemium to the benefit of premium, that has to happen. How soon does it happen and why are Spotify so hesitant on that?
Right.
Because it seems to me that that is inevitable, that that is going to have to be the next step. But we are still playing around and experimenting and desperately trying to work out what is going to work.
Right, absolutely. And I agree with you on that. And I think that's what's going on. And then that actually leads us to the other, I think where I really began to sort of sour on the streaming services. And I'm not 100% soured on them. I mean, I think the technology is great. I just think the business model isn't right. So, and this is where I really sort of begin to sour on it, is when I realize the difference between what we're getting on the ad-supported side versus what we're getting on the premium side. I think depending on when you make the calculation and how you make the calculation, you get, as an artist, you're getting somewhere between 7 and 10 times as much when it's a full price subscription listen versus an ad supported listen.
And I think it's interesting with Spotify. It always felt to me with the freemium versus the premium. When they first launched, it was very much pitched to me as, well, we've got two businesses here. We've got premium for the real music fans. Then we've got freemium here. We'll make a lot less money per play, but we'll get loads more people. We'll sell lots of advertising. It'll be great. And then after 2 or 3 years, it was like, oh, actually, we're not in advertising business. Freemium is just there to sell premium. And we all have to take a hit on freemium. Let's all agree we'll take a big hit on freemium, but if we can just sell enough premium, then we can all live with that. And so there was a shift from seeing the free service as actually being a core part of the business to free just being a way of upselling as many of the £10 a month subscriptions as you can.
Yes. The question is whether that's working. My question is, did they take people who were maybe spending $50, $60 a month, which may be equivalent soon, right? There may be a one-to-one correspondence between the pound and the dollar right now.
They're all no pounds. Let's stay with dollars.
Yeah. Well, so we'll say, did they take the $50, $60 a month music consumer and bring them down to 10 while not bringing up the $5 and $6 a month music consumer? You know what I mean? The cat bringing enough casual listeners into the subscription model. I don't know the answer to that. It doesn't seem like they did that.
You're right. We don't know. Perhaps that's one of the problems, is everyone's messing with their business models, but more people should be involved in that conversation. I suppose the positive spin might be what they have done is they've brought the $5, $6 a month up to $10, and then the $50 music fan is still buying vinyl, is still buying physical. They're doing the $10 a month, but then they're still spending $40 somewhere else on music, would be the optimistic possible thing that's happened.
That is the optimistic take, and I'm not saying it's wrong, but I feel like I was like one of those $50, $60 a month music buyers. And you know, when I began to criticize Spotify, they were very nice to me, and they sent me an email, had somebody reach out to me, and they gave me a premium subscription, and I stopped buying stuff. I behaved like every other consumer. I bought a lot less.
So therefore, if that is happening, then we need to turn a lot of $5 people into $10 people in order to compensate for that.
Right. Or maybe this windowing is helpful. I want to make a distinction, though. I think there's two kinds of windowing that people talk about, and I think one is unhelpful and one isn't. Say if you put a new album and say it's only available for download. I think that's actually a fairly smart strategy, or saying that it's only available on the premium tier of these streaming services.
If you say it's only on download, though, are you not then penalizing the premium subscribers who are actually, as the industry at large, they're our best customers? And so we're sort of saying, you're our best customers.
Are the record club people too. So I'm not convinced. I see that argument. I'm not 100% convinced of that. But I'll tell you which model I think is totally wrong, because it just feels like rent seeking, is putting a exclusive with just one single service.
No, I would agree with that. I mean, that is working for Tidal. Tidal are getting subscribers out of that.
I know.
But I agree. I can't see that's a long-term solution.
I know.
I
think that's short-term, get users for your services. Maybe that's good in the long run for artists. I don't know. But I'm a big supporter of different kinds of windowing, but that one feels wrong. And the other ones feel okay.
While we're with the sort of Spotify types, I suppose we ought to move on as time is running on.
With
the story that we have been talking about, and almost one of the reasons for getting you on here. So I mean, in essence, you made the distinction when we first started talking about Spotify between the money coming in on the recording side, on the publishing side, and we've discussed at length the ups and the downs and the issues on the recording side. And I suppose if we come to the publishing side, which is where we have the big issues, that particularly in the US. Well, first of all, one thing we know is that the publishing side gets way less than the recording side, and that's across the board in every country, on every streaming service. If you're not a singer-songwriter, you're the songwriter and not the performer, you will be seeing a lot less money, which sort of is a hangover from the CD era.
Right.
And then there has been the issue, which is a specifically US issue, which is the fact that for reasons that somebody once decided, there are two publishing royalties. There's the performing royalty and the mechanical royalty.
Right.
And in the US, the latter has sort of all hit a wall.
Right. You can look at it this way. People will disagree with this. In the US, there's exclusive rights under the Copyright Act for a copyright holder. You have distribution and copy being two different separate rights. So there's been a lot of like talk about, oh, well, they're really just one right and it was divided in half. There's actually a pretty good rationale for having a streaming mechanical and a public performance, right?
And actually, in here in Europe, we do the same for downloads, whereas in the US with downloads, it's just a mechanical, isn't it?
Yes, because it's considered not public.
Yeah.
So that's a problem. I don't think we should eliminate those two rights. But for instance, one solution would be to allow our PROs to license that mechanical streaming right.
And that is what happens everywhere else in the world.
Exactly.
So here in Europe, although in the UK, we make the distinction between the performing right and the mechanical right, and we have separate CMOs. We have PRS for the performing right and MCPS for the mechanical right. However, PRS and MCPS have long worked together. So when Spotify came along, along, and they said, okay, well, you need two licenses here, but you don't worry about that. Pretend it's one license, you pay us the money, and then we'll work out what to do with the money. And some of it feeds through PRS, some of it feeds through MCPS. There is then a big mystery about quite how that happens. And as a songwriter, that's actually quite important, because you get paid differently if it's coming through PRS versus MCPS. But crucially, those mechanical royalties are being paid. There may be imperfections along the way. So therefore, from a European perspective, it's like, well, we know BMI and ASCAP and the others are collecting the performing rights and presumably distributing them to songwriters. So why don't they just collect the mechanical rights too, and then we're sorted?
Right. So yes. And so what happened in the US was that some people did propose that we did that. There were various people who thought maybe it was a good idea to have the PROs, the BMIs, the ASCAPs, the C. Now we have four of them.
Yes.
We have maybe five of them with AMRA. The PROs can license the streaming mechanical. The problem is that the main two PROs are under something that's called a consent decree in the United States. It's a sort of a step in between charging someone with violations of antitrust laws.
And I mean, in the UK, we have something similar. It just sits within the Copyright Act. Whereas, yes, in the US, BMI ASCAP have bespoke documents from the Department of Justice, which says, all right, then you can be anti-competitive in collective licensing, providing you do, and then a big long list of things that someone came up with a very long time ago.
Excellent. That's a really great explanation. Very good. And that's so hard to explain to people, but yes, and that's what's going on. But one of the things is, because that list of things, you know, is also because that sits in the Department of Justice, the Department of Justice would actually have to say, well, okay, we're going to let the PROs license the mechanical streaming. And this was floated. And interestingly enough, many people, including certain publishers, it was kind of a mix of different commercial music entities in the United States and services that opposed it. So the streaming services opposed it. It wasn't a full-throated opposition, but yes, they opposed it. So in a sense, the problem that leads to the class action lawsuits probably could have been resolved if we had done this a few years ago.
Yeah, and just adopted the European model, which at that point, because the Spotify's of this world generally launched in Europe before they launched in the US, in most cases, that was how it was working over here. There are imperfections in that system, but it's working better than it is in the US.
Right, and that's a problem. The second thing is about the difference in the US is a question, and nobody can answer this for sure, but the question is whether the intention was to make it so that a streaming service wouldn't necessarily offer every song available. Okay, the idea being that at some point it's going to be too expensive to license every single song and we're not going to have every single song available on our service. Or whether it was just a settlement that just in effect did that, okay? Was this sort of the intention of the settlement or not? I wasn't party to that. I don't know. I don't know if anybody even had this discussion at the time. So there's a question of whether the US model was really designed to have every song available on a streaming service.
So I suppose whereas in Europe we have the blanket license that you get in performing rights applies to mechanicals. So the idea is every single song,
right,
providing you've got all your society licenses in place, you're covered for everything. So then just take everything from the labels, and whatever happens, we will pass some money on. So you're thinking that was the thinking in the US that in the same way that you can pick and choose on the recording side, you might pick and choose on the song side too to reduce liabilities or the effort of getting the money out there.
Yes, I've heard it both ways. So that was right, the intention, and that was not the intention, that it was just an accident. But regardless, we end up with this monstrosity, okay? And then along with the fact that this mechanical streaming rate, it's incredibly complex to explain how you get the mechanical streaming rate. It's a rate that's set by the Copyright Royalty Board in the United States. And
I suppose, the key thing to mention here is, like with the Sound Exchange on Pandora, with the mechanical in the US, which we don't have over here in the UK, it's a compulsory license. So again, it's set in law and the rate's set in law, and it's just sitting there waiting for the services to use.
Right. Of course, you have to do some very minimal things, which is
some formalities.
You have to send a notice of intent. The idea is that you have to find the songwriter or the rights holder and let them know you're using the song. So what ends up happening is that in order to do that for these streaming services in the United States, they had to hire Well, they didn't have to, but the way that it went about is that some of the streaming services hired HFA.
Or the Harry Fox Agency.
The Harry Fox Agency, which was a subsidiary until 2015 of the National Music Publishers Association.
To give some background, I suppose in the UK, we mentioned that we have a Collecting Society for Performing Rights, which is PRS, a Collecting Society for Mechanical Rights, which is MCPS. Likewise, MCPS is actually owned by the Music Publishers Association over here, but the MCPS operates as a collecting society, dishes out blanket licenses, everybody joins it. Mm-hmm. And I think here in Europe, because Harry Fox Agency is the closest you have to MCPS, it used to be that we just used to think of it as being like MCPS, but it's not. It's not a collecting society with blanket licenses. It's a middleman agency who users of music hire to go and find out who should be paid and then pay under the compulsory license and at that statutory rate.
Right. That's exactly it. And so we have something that looks just like that, except not everybody has to belong. And a lot of people don't want to belong to HFA or NMPA because they feel like they have to give up a cut and they're not getting much value for it, okay? So NMPA and HFA does not cover all songwriters and publishing rights holders.
Yeah.
And so for the streaming services to go to HFA and get those licenses, HFA had to take a second step. And for the publishers and rights holders who were not members of NMPA and Harry Fox Agency, they had to go out and obtain these compulsory licenses by sending the NOIs. And at least in my case, it looks like HFA, acting on behalf of Spotify, just never bothered to do that.
Yes. So I suppose just to clarify that, so whereas in the UK, MCPS represents pretty much everybody, so the money comes in, MCPS divvies it up. In the US, and it was always this way with the mechanicals on CDs too, Harry Fox has, and I think someone at the Great Escape this year said they had about 70% of people signed up. But for the 30% that aren't signed up, they either can't accept the money and the label or the service has to go and find it, or as what seemingly was happening here, they were taking the money off the services and in theory saying, oh, we'll go and find the people and we'll do the paperwork on the compulsory license, we'll pay at the statutory rate. But then, well, and what you're saying is, in your case, that never happened.
Right. And I would say 9 out of 10 of my friends who own their own publishing, it appears that that didn't happen either. That's not statistical proof that that happened across the board, but it's enough evidence that somebody should look into this.
And I mean, I know when you talk to labels over here, so obviously on the CD side, labels do the mechanical licensing rather than the services, which on streaming, it's a services problem. But I know over here, there are labels, including the label that you work with over here, Cooking Vinyl, who have gone on the record of saying even in the CD age, they would have money set aside to pay to Harry Fox to then pay to the publisher and the songwriter. And it was really hard to persuade Harry Fox to take the money and pass it on. So I think there is an element, what basically trying to say here is that the mechanical rights system in the US has never been particularly efficient, even in the CD age, let alone once we get into the streaming age with billions of tracks to sort out.
Absolutely. And part of my rationale with these lawsuits is to fix this. Now, you have to back up a second to see why I would think this. First of all, our copyright office in the United States has no enforcement powers. They just can state things and make recommendations and stuff like that. They have no enforcement power, right? Our Congress is gridlocked, doesn't really pass any laws. I don't see it passing any copyright reform laws. And so the last thing that we have in the United States that can affect changes like this is the courts. And that is essentially where the class action lawsuits come in.
So this, obviously, we've been reporting on this in great detail since it all kicked off last year. And I did an interview with your legal representative on this just before Christmas. But I suppose one question is interesting is, given that we've said that there were clearly issues without wanting to make any specific accusations or allegations, but clearly, I think we can say there have been issues with mechanical licensing across the board for decades. And that has impacted on a number of songwriters, at least in the US, in the streaming domain. And we feel that NMPA and their company until last year, Harry Fox Agency, were taking on work that they weren't then doing. So I suppose why go after the service rather than going after the agency that was the closest you had in the US to an MCPS that we have over here?
Well, because the services are the ones that are liable and not those in between third parties.
So this goes back to copyright law. Because it's Spotify using the compulsory license, legally, the law says you should go after the licensee.
Yes. But I would hope that as this proceeds, that the complicity or whatever happened with those third parties is investigated. And that's just a mess. And that just needs to be cleaned up.
You specifically targeted Spotify. I assume that was because on-demand streaming, they're the biggest of the Harry Fox customers.
There's another law firm in New York that basically filed class actions against a bunch of the other services.
It is true. Since yours was filed, one of them was before yours, wasn't it?
So essentially, I think my legal action would have looked different without that firm doing that. This took a long time to figure out, even if there was a case there. Right, I had to review my own documents for years and years, and I had to review contracts that were superseded by later contracts that were superseded by amendments, and I had to go around and ask old administrators, hey, did you cut this deal for me? There was a lot of work to be done. And
so looking at the publishers and administrators you'd worked with over the years for the songs that are in question here.
Yeah, I mean, we had to do a lot of work. I mean, I think it was 2 years of work. And the whole time that I'm doing this, I'm thinking that maybe this gets resolved before there even is a case that gets filed, but it didn't. I got to say this, that I'm surprised that this class action has been as adversarial as it has been, because another way to look at this, and maybe it's just a cultural difference, is this is one way that you fix stuff like this in the United States. We have more lawsuits in our country.
Yes,
we're more litigious. It's generally seen as a bad thing, but it also happens to be the way that stuff like this gets fixed. So if you look at Google embraces these class actions to the point where there's been suggestions that they actually wink at people and get them to file class actions so that they can resolve these problems. So I was a bit surprised that this was as adversarial as it became, because in some ways, this is the only way to absolve the streaming services. And this is something that could be applied across all the streaming services, I understand. This could be something that absolves all past infringement, wipes the slate clean, and even possibly gets to be one of these things where the Copyright Office blesses whatever relief going forward, and then that somehow gets put into law. This is the way these issues have been addressed in the past. So in some ways, I feel like I'm not just advocating for songwriters, but I'm also advocating for the shareholders in Spotify.
That's interesting. I suppose before the litigation had happened, given that we've sort of accepted that, okay, well, they outsourced it to an agency. Mm-hmm. We don't think the agency did a very good job under the law. The service is the licensee, therefore they are liable. Other than hiring a different agency, I mean, I assume they went with Harry Fox because they were the biggest and people said, oh, everyone uses Harry Fox, use Harry Fox. Is there anything that you think they could have done 2 years ago to address this issue, given that we know that mechanical rights have always been a bit of a mess in the US?
Well, I mean, I think they could have ingested the songwriter information. And I know they use a lot of third parties. I know record labels probably resisted giving them the songwriter information because they don't always have it either. What if federal regulations were changed? I mean, we can change regulations without changing the law. There's a little bit of a leeway there. It's possible that if there was some sort of consensus between rights holders, both on the publishing and the recording side, record labels and the streaming services, that we could have made it some sort of a rule, not quite a law, that you ingested the songwriter information at the same time the recording was uploaded.
And put the obligation on the labels and distributor.
Yes, right. I realize that that's a simpler thing to say than it is to actually accomplish, but I think that could have gone a long way to preventing this problem. The other thing is you don't have to send an NOI necessarily to the publisher or the rights holder, that notice of intent to get the compulsory license. There's sort of an exemption where you can also send it to the Copyright Office under certain conditions, but it's prohibitively expensive.
And that system wasn't really set up for streaming service trying to do millions of tracks at once. Yeah. It was set up for labels licensing 10 tracks on an album.
Yeah, it's recorded on PDFs. at the copyright office. Was there some accommodation there? Yes, I think there's accommodation there. But the main thing is that this little sort of rat's nest that surrounded these third parties, HFA and the NMPA, acting as if they could license everybody when they couldn't, that's really your problem right there.
Yeah.
I mean, the streaming services are liable. They should have done their due diligence on that. But I'll tell you right up, I happen to agree with the streaming services that that was the problem right there. And so if nothing else, that even if these class actions fail to be certified, whatever, and stuff like that, if we stop doing that, that at least is an improvement.
No, and I know one thing that a lawyer over here said to me is whether it's actually through your action in court or whether, I mean, there isn't any time to go into it, but obviously the NMPA, having sold the Harry Fox agency, or have come together with some sort of proposal and a deal with Spotify. But one lawyer was saying, whatever your opinion is and however messy things might be at the moment, if at the end of this there is something more like MCPS in the US, which for all of its imperfections is way better than what you've got in America.
Absolutely.
Well, that would be a happy outcome for everybody.
Right. And I think we are moving that way. My hope is that as a result of moving towards that, that in the digital realm, the songwriters have seen their incomes fall the farthest. That if somehow there's a give there for songwriters where we get a little more, because I'm both a performer and a songwriter, but I think most of the money I make really is, well, a bare majority of the money that I make comes from publishing. So I would like to see those revenues increased. I mean, I'm a songwriter first and foremost. Yeah. I know I'm a performer, but really I'm a songwriter.
And there's various ways that can be achieved, one of which is ensuring that no cent is lost to the system.
Right. And I mean, I don't know what happened. I assume mechanical streaming royalties were being paid somewhere for the last 10 years since there's been streaming in the United States. I just don't know where it was going. I mean, I don't know who has it. Does a Harry Fox agency have it? Is it escrowed in the streaming services accounts? I don't really know. But I think actually, fundamentally, though, that songwriter's rate is too low. And we have to rebalance that. And if that's another thing that comes out of these class actions, that would be good.
Now, time is vastly running out, but I've just got two other quick questions to which sort of come back to something that we talked about before. I mean, beyond the mechanical rights issue, and we talked about the fact that the Spotify model, and I'm using Spotify here now to just mean the on-demand model as opposed to the Pandora model. That people are experimenting. Obviously, Spotify, Deezer still have the free premium thing going on. Tidal, Apple Music are saying, oh, we don't need that. But, I mean, it seems to me, looking just at the figures, that those subscription services are the future of the recorded music industry. Not necessarily in their exact current form, but CDs continue to slowly go down. Downloads are tanking. So a Spotify-type model is the future. And I think Apple Music may be great, but I worry about services which are ultimately side parts of a business. You know, Apple isn't in the music industry, it just happens to have a music service, where Spotify is in the music industry. So I do see them as being the future recorded music business.
Right.
I mean, would you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely.
And do you think,
I mean, I don't want to have to necessarily have every file for every track that I own on my iPhone or my Android device or my tablet. I completely understand that. The question is now, it's not that we're against the railroads. The question is like, how much are we going to pay the railroad workers or something like that?
Yeah.
It's almost like a labor action now.
But we'd have the issue which you brought up earlier on, which is we can ask these services for more money, but we know they're all losing money. And they have big headcounts and they're spending a lot of money to aggressively grow because their business model requires ridiculous scale. So obviously there are some economies there, but ultimately they are all loss-making services and everybody needs them to go into profit at some point because clearly they can't be loss-making forever. Do you think ultimately it's, well, we haven't quite got the right business model yet. We just wish that the services would talk more to the labels and crucially to the artists about where the business model's going. And are you ultimately optimistic or do you think it's too soon to say whether or not this is going to work?
Well, they're much more likely to be profitable standalone services. They're subscription-based. Just because there's a secular decline in advertising per view advertising rates. So they're more likely to be successful if they're subscription-based.
Yeah.
And that is in artists' interest to see these services move towards subscription-based models because we get more revenue out of it. The question of whether they're standalone entities, we have to remember that hardware manufacturers used to own record labels. You know, EMI, the RCA. There's been an ebb and flow in the music industry over the last 100 years where recording companies are basically parts of companies that sell the hardware, and then they've been independent, and it's kind of gone back and forth over 100 years. There's problems with that, like, you know, that Apple is in the business of selling hardware, and so if, you know, Apple becomes the main streaming service, but there's also maybe extra revenue on the table for rights holders. So I haven't made up my mind about that, but this is part of the ebb and flow in the music business, is how much the people who make the hardware, the systems to listen to music, the systems to download the music and such like that are often selling music as a, at a loss. I don't...
Because some artists don't like the fact that an Apple makes so much money on the devices which they don't share with the music services where they're on break even or they're not making a huge amount of money, or in the case of Apple Music, I assume losing money. But you're almost saying, but there are quid pro quo here, because if it means that they can be successful and a little bit more generous because they have another business on the side. And as you say, I mean, that mm-hmm. is back in the early days of vinyl records, that was the same thing that was going on.
Right. And it's both sort of disturbing, and then I haven't made up my mind on that, is what I'm saying. Yeah. But there's trade-offs there.
And finally, because time is way, way, way over now.
Sorry.
it's all been too interesting. That's the problem. You started right off, surprisingly, saying one of your first digital adventures was with YouTube.
Right.
Way back in whenever that was, 2008. Obviously, it's interesting that while you have been challenging and writing about the sort of the Spotify models, in the main, as far as the mainstream record industry is concerned, we know actually that Universal for certain has a bit of a problem with the freemium thing on Spotify. But in the main, the labels are the subscription streaming services. They're fine. They're growing. They're bringing in most of our money at the moment. We're happy with them in the short term. Enemy number one is YouTube. And YouTube is killing the industry. YouTube is stopping the Spotify's of the world, the Apple Music of the world from growing. This is what the labels are saying, not necessarily what I am saying. And obviously, we've seen this has been a big issue in Europe for about 18 months now, ramped up in the US in the last couple of months. Just last week, we had the letter from Irving Azoff, signed by 180 artists, big-name artists, calling for reform of the safe harbours. I mean, is this something that is also concerning you? Is it something that you are being as vocal about as the other guys and as vocal as you are about challenges in the subscription streaming space?
Short answer, yes. And YouTube has always been at the top of my list. You know, I mean, for the beginning of like, oh, I'm going to be outspoken about this. And maybe in some ways we've been sidetracked on that a little bit. But the fact is, the DMCA safe harbors, if you look across the digital services, right? I mean, all the way across them, right? The DMCA safe harbors are not abused by everyone. Look, Spotify has to rely on them. Pandora has to rely on them. You know, it's possible people upload things that they don't have the rights to and stuff like that. You have to insulate these services from liability. So that's just fair, right? You know, somebody claims they have the rights to something, they upload it, right? Even companies like eBay, Apple, Microsoft, these all rely on the DMCA safe harbors for some insulation by actions by their users, right? But they don't really make a business out of it. And YouTube has made a business of essentially hiding behind their users, the DMCA safe harbors, to essentially have the largest music library out there. Right. And I cannot believe, I mean, you've got to be like a flat earth society believer to think that that is what Congress intended with the DMCA safe harbors, or that the European governments, the British government, such like that intended enacted similar laws, right? They did not intend for services to be built on this.
But I suppose then the big question is, particularly given what you've already said about US Congress at the moment, I mean, I agree with you, that's not what was envisaged in the 90s, not least because nobody could envisage something like YouTube in the 90s. But do you think that safe harbor laws are going to be rewritten to the music industry's advantage? And if not, do you think, which I know some of the people I've spoken to, particularly in the US record industry, are saying is, well, actually, what we're really trying to do here is embarrass Google and YouTube into coming to the table and being more friendly in negotiations?
Well, I don't know what the label strategy is with this. I would actually like to see some reform of the DMCA. I mean, it clearly wasn't intended to be used this way, to have multi-billion dollar companies build businesses on their essentially their users' infringement.
Yeah. But do you think you'll get that realistically?
Realistically, we're not going to get it in the next couple years. But yeah. I think just hammering people with, look at it, look how it works, look how fundamentally unfair it is. I mean, we just have to keep pointing this out to the public so ultimately we do get a fair hearing in Congress and something is done about this. I don't know if it happens in the next couple of years. Maybe in the meantime, if that's what the label strategy is, to get, say, YouTube to behave more like the other, so maybe the better digital services.
Yeah.
If they do start behaving like that, that would be great. That would be a victory in itself.
I'm not entirely convinced that they will, but I think it's a quicker strategy than the legislative strategy.
You're absolutely right. That is absolutely a quicker strategy, and hopefully it works. But I mean, I think ultimately we have to have a legislative change.
Well, we've used up far too much of your time. It's been a fascinating conversation, and I suppose one of the outcomes being that although we possibly disagree on some things, we both agree that we're still in the midst of a big experiment here.
Absolutely.
I don't think anybody really knows where we're going to end up. We know certain services are gaining huge traction, and that is working well for some rights owners and some artists. But I suppose, A, will those services become profitable? And if so, which kinds of services are going to become profitable? And B, in terms of how the money then gets shared between the music community, I think it does skew towards, as you said, to artists to have a small number of singles that were big radio play singles that are still getting playlisted now versus the album artist. And is that just something we have to accept as a creative community? There's a shift, or is there something that could be done with the way the money is shared to ensure that both forms of artists get a cut of the pie?
Right. We don't know that yet, but
we don't.
It's not a problem without a solution, though, is I firmly believe that.
We've just got to find the solution.
Yes.
There's an almost upbeat ending.
Yes, absolutely.
And if either of us come across a solution at some point, we'll have to have another conversation.
Absolutely.
And we can assess it. Anyway, thanks so much for your time.
Well, thank
really
you for having me on.
No problem. Okay. And hopefully we will get to talk again, and it all moves on so rapidly. Who knows where we'll be in a year's time.
Great. Thank you very much.
So thanks very much to David for joining us on this special edition of the CMU podcast. A very interesting conversation. We are thinking about having some more special editions like this, where we talk to people who are in the news, who we're talking about one week because of some event that has happened, and then we do a little conversation with them another week where we sort of get to delve quite deeply into their opinions or the projects they're working on. We haven't organised any of that yet, though, but it is our plan to do some more special editions down the line, so that's something to look forward to. But next week on the podcast, it will be myself and Andy delving into the previous week, or maybe fortnight, given we've had this special edition this week. So we'll be back next week with the normal format. So yeah, all the usual stuff, sign up, subscribe, reviewers, sign up to the daily, the CMU Daily at completemusicupdate.com. As always, this was a podcast presented by me, Chris Cook. It was produced by Matt Peaty. For more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at Unique Facilities, the CMU podcast is an unlimited production in association with 7 Digital.